Luke chapter 16, verses 1 through 13. Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer.' The manager said to himself, 'What shall I do now? My master has taken away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses.' So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' 900 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, 'And how much do you owe?' 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, 'Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." Now, the first time I read this passage, I was like, I don't think I get it. And then the second time I read it, it was like, I don't get it. And then the third time I was like, I don't think this is even supposed to be in here. No, it is supposed to be in here, but even some commentators agree that there has been a lot of question and confusion over this passage, and I will admit there was for me too, but I really think it is what it seems to be. This guy was handling his boss's affairs dishonestly. He got busted for it, and he realized that he was soon about to be out of a job, and so before he was left out on the street with nothing, he was going to get in good with some of his boss's clients, do good by them, and hopefully they will, in turn, remember him when he has nothing. So he devises a plan that even his former boss had to admit was a pretty good one. But as a preacher, I'm supposed to look at something like this and go, what application can I make for the people? What are we supposed to learn from this? That it's okay to be a dishonest bum as long as you look out for your future? I really don't think that was it. Jesus would never commend a dishonest action or make the dishonest action the point of his parable. So let's look at it again, verse by verse. Verse number 1, Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions." Now, these were probably not formal charges brought against him, but merely complaints probably made by other managers or possibly some of the clients. So he called him in and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer." Obviously, there was truth to these accusations, or the boss thought there was, because he seems to have believed them, because his question, "What is this I hear about you?" doesn't seem to be expecting much of an answer. And to borrow from Donald Trump, you're fired. The manager said to himself, "What shall I do now? My master has taken away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." And maybe he had some physical infirmity that would have made physical labor impossible, or maybe he was just lazy and proud. Whatever the reason, he devises a plan. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 900 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, "And how much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. He had no problem using his position for his own benefit, even if it meant cheating his boss. Knowing that he was about to lose his job, he plans for his future by discounting the debts, thus obligating those people to himself. Now, commentators disagree whether or not this act in itself was also dishonest. Was he giving away what he really had no place to give away, or was he removing interest, or possibly even removing his own commission? If you assume that these are Jews we are talking about, a Jew was not supposed to charge interest to another Jew, but some Jews figured out that if they just overcharged the person to begin with, they could circumvent that rule. I mean, after all, if you don't actually call it interest, then it's not really interest, right? It's possible that he was returning the figures to their original amounts, which would both satisfy his boss and put him in good standing with the clients. At any rate, he was shrewd, clever enough to use the means at his disposal to plan for his future. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. Now, is he commending the man for being dishonest when he had just fired him for that same dishonesty? I doubt it. And as I said earlier, Jesus would not make a dishonest act the point of his parable. It's more likely that the boss is commending his former employee for looking after himself when he no longer has a job. He's thinking about his future, which might explain the last part of this verse. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. Now, this is an interesting verse, and I looked at it in various translations, and they all pretty much say the same thing. The people of the world are more clever. They show more judgment than do God's people. Meaning what exactly? That God's people don't think enough about their futures? That God's people are not very good at business? It's kind of hard to say exactly, but I think the idea is that Christians don't always think enough about their dealings with other Christians. Case in point, I have seen where Christians have taken advantage of other Christians simply because they were Christians. And they develop this attitude of, you owe this to me because you are a brother or a sister in Christ. And it turns into one person thinking that they can take and take, and the other person should give and give because, well, that is what Christians do. They give to their fellow Christians. But what that turns into eventually is animosity and friction, and at some point, that relationship is going to crumble. Sometimes we use our both being Christians as a license to manipulate and use and take advantage. Now, we would never say that that's what we're doing. We certainly wouldn't like to think of our actions in those terms. But if we were actually going to be brutally honest, that's probably what we were doing. But you don't lay out anything good for your future that way. Something that even the people of the world have figured out. Verse number 9, I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Did Jesus really just say to use worldly wealth to try and get into heaven? What am I going to do, buy off an angel at the gates? Or buy off Peter and bribe him to let me in? Hey, look, I know my robe is on fire, but come on, here's $100. No, I don't think Peter is a gatekeeper anyway. God's people should be alert to make use of what God has given them, to give to someone else, to help someone else. One good turn deserves another. Let's not take the good that is done to us and not pass that on to someone else. Some have even seen in this passage a lesson on stewardship, people being the stewards of God's earth, and I don't really think that they're out of line for that thinking. Clearly, stewardship has a role in this passage, and there is no question that this earth and everything in it belongs to God, but that he has placed us in charge of it the same way he did Adam and Eve. If you look at Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15, it says, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. And 1 Corinthians 4, 2, says, now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. This earth is our trust. Our families are our trust. Our churches are our trust. And we must prove faithful in our management of them. Now that should make us stop and think for a couple of minutes. Now maybe we personally are doing a pretty good job of taking care of this earth. We're responsible hikers and recyclers and all that. But what about our families and our churches? Have we as parents let our kids have all the control and we are ultimately raising a bunch of spoiled brats who feel like all they should have to do is raise their voice to get what they want? I used to raise my voice as a kid, and it got me something. But not particularly what it was that I was going for. Parents, we are responsible for the kids we raise, and guess what? The word no doesn't kill them. The phrase, because I said so, I heard that one a lot, doesn't kill them. And discipline and an occasional punishment for breaking the rules doesn't kill them either. It may, in fact, have the opposite effect. Parents are stewards of the children God has blessed them with, but how responsible are we being with that trust? And who really cares if the church is full of inconsistency and hypocrisy? Who really cares that the people who come aren't getting the encouragement that they should be? Who cares that they are not getting the instruction and guidance from the scriptures that they should be? Who really cares that the relationships the Christians have outside of the church mean more to them than the relationships inside the church, because those inside the church are full of fake sincerity and judgment and criticism? Well, I hope we do care. The church is our trust, so I hope we think of it as a lot more than a place I can come and try and throw my weight around to get some things going my way. In fact, I hope that that thought doesn't cross our mind at all. You know, there are a lot of really, really good people in this world. There absolutely are. I know there are some creeps and some people who aren't really all that mean, but I mean, you know, that just kind of comes with the territory. But there are a lot of really good people on this earth. But something happens to a person when you put them inside a car. Suddenly they become, they are scary and fearless and they have absolutely no patience and they become downright mean. Unfortunately, you put some people in a church and they turn into manipulators and whiners and troublemakers and the apparent authority on everybody else. But that's because they have forgotten that the church is a trust and we must be responsible with that trust. Don't abuse it. Don't mishandle it. And don't take its life away. And by the way, remember that the church is not yours to begin with. It is not mine either. It was Jesus Christ who died for that church. It was his blood, not ours. All of these things are a trust that has been placed in our care, and God will hold us responsible for how well we managed that trust. And if Jesus has an eye on stewardship in this passage, it would mean that he is trying to tell us that how well we manage these things down here has an impact on what we have up there. Verse number 10 of our text. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. If you give me $20 to hold on to, and I keep a tight fist on it the whole time I have it, and I protect that $20 as if it were a priceless diamond necklace, imagine what I will do to protect the actual diamond necklace if you were to ever give it to me. But if I just stuff that $20 into my pocket and just let it get wet and eventually I lose it because I just really don't care that much and I kind of forgot it was in there anyways. When did you give that to me? Like 4 months ago? Because after all, it's only $20. Will you trust me with that necklace? Not a chance. And yes, I realize $20 now. I mean, you know, hey, $20, that's a half a gallon of gas today, right? But hopefully you still understand the point behind that I'm trying to make here. Are you going to trust me with that necklace after I disintegrated your $20? Not a chance. You wouldn't take that risk. Verse 11. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? Again, looking at this idea of stewardship, how well we manage our affairs down here has an impact on what we have up there. The size of the responsibility does not matter, nor do the specifics. What matters is what did you do with your responsibility? In the parable of the talents, it didn't matter how many talents each one had. What matters was what each one did with what he did have. And at the end, during the, you know, judgment phase, I guess, if you want to call it that. But when they were called to give an account, you know, to show what they had produced, not one of them was judged based on how many talents he started with. Well, obviously there was a problem with you because you didn't start with five. You started with one, or you started with two. That wasn't the point. The responsibility, the being held accountable, was not for what you started with in the beginning, but what did you do with what you had been entrusted with? You see, friends, it's that way in the church as well. It's that way in the Christian's life. Well, I've never been a preacher. You don't have to be. You know, I've never been a missionary. You don't have to be. Well, I never had, you know, a great big family. You don't have to be. It doesn't matter what kind of responsibility you've been given, how much responsibility you've been given, whether it be the equivalent to the 5 talents or the 2 talents or the 1 talent. What matters is, what did you do with the responsibility you have been given? Each is given a talent based on his or her abilities and opportunities. The person who gets the 1 is not, that's not another way of the master saying you're only getting 1 because you're not as good as the guy who gets 5. It has absolutely nothing to do with that. Certainly not in the eyes of God. It didn't matter how many talents each one had. What matters was what each one did with what he did have. What matters is that everything belongs to God and he has placed them in our care, which already requires a certain amount of trust. And considering that he's working with people, that's a considerable risk. And yet he does it anyways. Some have lost their position of manager because they have neglected their families. They have neglected their children. They have neglected their churches, and now they don't have any of them. No one can serve 2 masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. How does verse 13 tie in with this steward? He was, in the beginning, trying to serve both of his masters. One of his masters was, of course, his boss. And the other master was this master of his own indulgence, his own selfishness. And the one betrayed him to the other. We cannot serve both God and our own indulgences, no matter what those indulgences are. Whether those indulgences are sinful indulgences, or whether they are mere apathy and irresponsibility. We have a choice we have to make. One of them has to be let go. We either have to be a steward to ourselves or a steward to God. And as this man learned, they both carry consequences. A consequence is simply the end result of something. It is neither good nor bad inherently. What determines whether a consequence is good or bad depends on the action. A consequence can feel like a reward or it can feel like a punishment. It can bring gain or it can bring loss. And as this man learned, following his own master of indulgence brought about a consequence that was a loss. As Christians, it's time that we started thinking about how we are managing our affairs, about how we are managing the trust that God has placed in our care, because not only will the consequence be felt down here on this earth in this life, but if I understand God's Bible correctly, there will be a consequence felt on the other side of this life as well. And I certainly want that consequence to be in the form of reward and gain, not punishment and loss. But before I can have that, I have to understand what he meant when he said, you cannot serve God and money, or God and mammon, as some translate that. Choose this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And friend, I hope that that is true for you as well.